Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hi, this is Ed Camo, and we're here on Fire Marshal's Corner. Thanks for joining us on Radio at Firehouse.com, and we have a great show lined up this month. We've kind of gone international, but first we're going to start in the United States, where we're talking with Kathy Gerstner, who is a fire program specialist with the U.S. Fire Administration, and she's going to be telling us about their new online fire fatality reporting system that gives us great information on the fire fatalities that are occurring in real time, which is an absolutely invaluable service that they've come up with. So we asked Kathy to join us and fill us in on that. Then we are going international with Phil Shaneman, who's the president of the Tri-Data Division of System Planning Corporation, who just completed a study on fire service in the United Kingdom and Sweden. And he had some incredible findings in terms of what they are doing from a fire prevention point of view that I think we can really learn a lot about what they're doing for us here in the United States. And then we're going to be wrapping up with a talk with Stephen King, who's with C3 Construction Code Consultants. He's over in the United Arab Emirates, helping them try to get their code consulting operations up and running. And they have an incredibly unique problem over there that they are doing, and they're just building like crazy right now. And they don't have a consistent code over there. They're using a variety of international codes. So Stephen's been working closely with the government over there, trying to get a handle on it. They're reviewing like 30 plan reviews a day on high-rise buildings over there, just incredible growth. So Stephen has some absolutely fascinating stories to tell us about working over in the United Arab Emirates. So sit back and listen to this month's issue of Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Camo on Radio at Firehouse.com.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hi, this is Ed Camo. We're here on Fire Marshal's Corner with Kathy Gerstner, who is a fire program specialist with the U.S. Fire Administration. Thanks for joining us, Kathy.
Thank you, Ed.
Kathy's going to be talking about kind of a new old program, the Quick Response Program, which has been in place for some time, but you put a new addition to it, which I think is a great one. It's going to be really valuable. So maybe, Kathy, you can start with explaining what the Quick Response Program is all about and what you put into it, the new addition to it.
Okay. The Quick Response Program, which we call Fire Safety in the News, was an attempt by USFA, I think they started it about 12 years ago, to get or to promote fire safety and prevention messages in the news. The way that it works is that we monitor the news through various and sundry means. I think Google is probably one of the main ones nowadays, to find fatal residential fires, or fatalities, I should say, throughout the country. And after we learn of a fatal fire, we send fact sheets on fire issues to news desks in the affected area. The program's based on the concept of the teachable moment, and that is the period immediately after a fire where there's heightened concern and awareness about the dangers of fire. People tend to be more receptive to those messages at that time. The intended result is to increase messaging about fire prevention and safety in news stories and in turn increase public awareness.
And so what kind of reaction have you had to it? It's been in place for 12 years. Is it something that the news media does use this information to put together the stories? Because I really agree with you on that teachable moment concept, but it's such a narrow window of time.
It is. We have very good reactions from the media. We deal with a lot of media, particularly in smaller towns and rural locations, because when we contact them immediately after the fire, we send them information on various and sundry topics, you know, related to preventing fires. And if we can identify what that fatal fire was caused from, we send a fact sheet about that particular fire, cause of fire. If we can't, we send one about smoke alarms. But along with sending this information, we do some follow-up by phone and ask them if they've received the materials and if they were helpful, and would they like to interview someone at USFA and offer them, you know, other materials and information that USFA may have. So our comments on the whole program all along have been very positive.
Okay. Well, what are some of the, you mentioned you have various fact sheets with various topics. What are some of the topics that you do have available?
We have 16 fact sheets. I'm not going to read them all off to you, but heater, alternate heater safety, candle fires, careless smoking, children in fire. We have one on escape planning, generator safety, home fire sprinklers, holiday fires, and winter fires. Our default is smoke alarms. If we don't know the cause of the fire, then we send our fact sheet on smoke alarms.
And are these available online through the USFA website?
Yes, they're all available online, as is a description of the quick response program itself. And there's another piece to the quick response program. I don't know if you want me to get into that right now, but that's
sure.
The quick response media corps.
Sure.
Which is primarily for fire departments, even though we call it Media Corps. People can sign up via the email on our website and belong to the Media Corps. And the purpose of that is that we send information to those folks probably 3 or 4 times a year related to dealing with the media. In other words, we give them suggestions about how to get stories into the local newspaper, how to be interviewed in their own community after a fire. And we also, something important that I forgot to put in there before, not just for the Media Corps, but for everybody, is when we send the information to the communities initially after the fatal fire, we also send those same fact sheets to the fire departments in the area. And all of this is a way to try to get the fire departments and the media with the same messaging about fire safety. So it also alerts the fire department that we've contacted the media in their area. So it's kind of, there's several different things that we do, and it kind of all comes around the idea of trying to get messaging into media for the people in the community so they can become more aware of fire safety and prevention.
Now, you mentioned you use Google, and I use it myself. I mean, it's unbelievable service in terms
yes.
of identifying when these things are happening and where they happen. How quickly can you respond to it? I mean, there's obviously a lot of fires happening every single day.
Yes.
So what's your turnaround time from when an incident happens that you're able to get this information to the media?
We attempt to get it there within 24 hours, but I'm going to say it's probably 24 to 48 hours, depending on exactly when the fire happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if it, this is just during the week also. So Mondays are a heavy day for us through this program because we're scanning for Saturday and Sunday. So therefore, we don't work on Saturday and Sunday, so we don't get anything out then.
Right. Now, you'd mentioned that this is for residential fires, right?
Yes.
Okay. Is there some reason it's restricted just to residential fires versus all occupancies?
It is restricted to residential fires because USFA's primary focus is residential fires. That's where the majority of fatalities occur. I think it's 80%.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have always focused more on residential than on other types of fires. Obviously, that's where the most of the people die, so that's where we try to zero in.
Well, let's talk about the new addition you've made to this service, which I think is just a great one because a lot of people in this country, including the fire service, don't really understand or appreciate how frequently fires do happen across the country. And you guys just started something new that I'd really love everybody to know about because I think it's absolutely invaluable in terms of making people aware of the scope of the national fire problem. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Just recently, we've added a new piece where every day we update on the USFA homepage the number of fatalities that were reported from the previous day. And if you go into that, click on that link, you go in and see the reports as we get them, and they're usually pretty short, but they're day by day. They give the location, that is the city and the state, and the victims, usually age, and if it's a male or a female, and if we know the cause of the fire, then that's included. So it's just a one or two sentence in most cases. So you can go in there and look each day and see what was reported to USFA through quick response. There's also an Excel sheet that you can that's attached to this page that you can click on a link and go to see them broken out one by one. Each victim is listed and the date that it was reported and the date of the fire and just that basic information that we have, whatever we have about that victim's circumstances when they died. I think it's a good addition. The reason that I was receptive when it was suggested to me by Ed Camo to getting it out on the website is that since we already do quick response and I get a daily report here at USFA, so I've been tracking this for years, every week I write a weekly report to remind everybody here at USFA that, you know, there are still people dying in fires. And Ed pointed out that we were not, you know, sharing this with anyone else, and I thought, boy, that's true. So the whole point of doing it is for people to see, you know, this isn't just something in the back of your mind. Every single day we have reports of fatal fires. So the whole purpose of it is to keep to remind all of us that this is an ongoing problem, and we need to keep working to reduce or eliminate fatal fires.
And I really think you hit the nail on the head. You kind of embarrassed me there. I wasn't looking for a plug on that
guy. Well, but, you deserved one.
Well, but I mean,
I know a good suggestion when I hear one or read it.
I mean, we had a lot of discussion on. There are other people involved in this too. We have a listserv called E-Parade, which Kathy's mm-hmm. on and knows very active, and a lot of people were talking about this sort of thing, and we were kind of comparing it to what law enforcement does, where they yeah. really publicize the tragedies that happen to make people more aware of the issues of crime, and they've done it very successfully, and that's why we thought, well, why not do the same thing for fire?
I agree, because I think people forget about it till it happens in your community to somebody next door to you, or it's one of the terrible multiple death fires that, you know, we all read about and see in the national news. But otherwise, all of those ones and twos that die out in some rural area in Montana or someplace like that, the rest of us don't know anything about that.
Right.
We don't think about it.
And I think this is a great way to bring it to the forefront, to really remind people, especially, I really like that spreadsheet. I use that on a very frequent basis, but it does compile
great.
It all in one, you know, easy kind of look at a glance sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the important thing to put on here, and you have it on your website too, is this isn't a real official reporting system. You're getting all this through the media services, so you're probably missing a number of them too, just because they just don't necessarily get picked up by the media for whatever reason. So there's,
Ed, we estimate that we're missing 50% of them.
Right. So,
if you look at the number and double it, that's probably more like what is actually happening out there. But you're right. Many of the deaths are they're not even reported. So it's very common in a lot of places, you know, to have a one fatality in a residential fire, unfortunately.
Now, and there's a mechanism on your website, too, for people to report fires they know about
yes.
that didn't appear, isn't there?
Yes, yes. And I don't know, it hasn't been up there long enough now. I think it's been, 3 weeks, maybe, for people to know about it. But I expect that people will do that right. as they find out about it.
Well, all the people listening to this podcast hopefully will use that, too, so that if a fire does happen in your community that didn't make it to the quick response program, you can send an email to USFA just through their website giving them the details on it, and they can
exactly.
get included in that summary. So I think that between, you know, that mechanism and the media, you know, over time you'll just get a more and more complete, you know,
mm-hmm.
reporting system that'll just give all of us
great
big picture of what's happening when it comes to fire deaths in the country.
I hope so. I know that I've been contacted by people in the National Fire Data Center,
mm-hmm.
and of course they get their information from the states, who get it from the community, so theirs is always behind. They can't. They don't have what you might call real-time reporting. But they're going to be keeping an eye on this as time goes by, so they can compare it to the statistics that they're getting.
Oh, that's
so
great.
I think that may be helpful to them, you know, at some point.
Well, I think that's fantastic, and mm-hmm. you really just said it right there. This is real time. I think that's what's so powerful about this, is that this is real time information that we all can use to try to push forward the cause of fire prevention and fire safety in the country by just saying,
thanks.
These fires are happening, and you know we need to pay more attention to it. So
I agree.
I really appreciate you putting this information out there, Kathy. This is just going to be, I think, one of the biggest assets to the fire service and fire prevention folks, and having this information in hand, and couple that with what you're doing with the media to try to, again, use that teachable moment. You know, it's really mm-hmm. hats off to USFA. I think this is a great program you guys have there.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
And I appreciate your input.
Not
just the good positive stuff, but the rest of it too.
we've been talking with Kathy Gerstner, who's a fire program specialist with the U.S. Fire Administration, talking about the quick response program and some of the other related programs that they have going on at USFA. So thanks for taking the time to join us, Kathy.
You're quite welcome. It was my pleasure.
And joining us today is Phil Shaman, who's the president of Tri-Data Corporation. Thanks for joining us, Phil.
You're very welcome.
Phil just completed a study of some international fire services, which is actually a continuation of a series that he did a number of years ago. There were excellent studies on international fire safety and fire departments and fire services. So we asked Phil to join us today to kind of fill us in on what he has found in the recent studies. So, Phil, maybe you can just start by telling us what countries you took a look at.
Earlier this year, we visited the United Kingdom, which was both England and Scotland, and we also visited two countries in Scandinavia, Sweden and Norway.
And, you know, you must have found a lot that's quite a bit different from the way we do things over here in the United States. What were some of the differences you noticed in these countries about how they approach fire safety and firefighting?
Well, what we found was actually much more extraordinary than we had expected. The British Fire Service has undergone nothing less than a major sea change in the last 10 years. It's a fire marshal's dream in ways. They have made a major shift toward prevention.
Hmm.
And it is codified in national law that says they're required to do prevention. Their national law now says every firefighter, and it is in the firefighter's contracts, must participate in prevention if asked, and most of them are asked. And they have abandoned their standards of cover.
Oh, really? Wow.
There used to be requirements that if you were risk A or B or C or D level, then you had so many minutes to get to a fire with so many pumps and so many ladders. That's all gone now.
Oh, that is a major sea change, because I remember that was a big thing that they had set up over there to really establish a standard of response across the country.
So while we are trying to figure out how to fight fires with more firefighters, they're saying let's let local governments decide on what the proper answer is to doing a detailed risk analysis. And we know that the answer is going to be doing a lot more prevention, so you better do it.
What drove that change? What made that big sea change happen, as you called it?
Well, the changes happened from a number of things going on at the same time. One was a particular individual, Graham Meldrum, who happened to be the chief of West Midlands, and he started an initiative to do more home fire safety emphasis than had ever been done before. He ultimately wound up getting knighted and made Her Majesty's chief inspector, and that was so successful he got fired. He abolished the position. But he was stimulated, in part, I'm very proud to say, by some past Tri-Data research on reaching the hard-to-reach and proving public fire education works. In 1996, I gave a talk at a British conference, which I did not realize was the pivot point in their decision-making, on the importance of prevention and showing that the ounce of prevention truly was worth the pound of cure, and that we can measure the effectiveness of prevention and that we should be targeting the hard to reach. Well, that added sand to one side of the scale, and they helped take fire and research shows that we should do more prevention, so they did it. Now, the really revolutionary thing they're doing is how they're reaching the hard-to-reach. In the past, we have targeted campaigns toward low-income population and various ethnic populations, and they said, let's reach the hard-to-reach directly face-to-face. So what they are doing is going to homes of high-risk households, and they're doing it en masse. So a place like the Liverpool area is targeting 50,000 households a year to go to, and over the period of 5 years, they reach 250,000 households, which are about half of all that they have in the community. They're choosing the households to reach based on sophisticated risk analysis and excellent data that shows not only where fires have been occurring, but where they're likely to occur based on socioeconomic factors and a variety of other factors that are used in marketing. And they're using the same set of factors to say what kinds of appeals would work best for the different households.
So what's the source of that data? Is that data that they are collecting as a fire service, or are they tapping into databases from elsewhere?
Well, first of all, they're collecting data much better than we are as a fire service. They have close to 100% of fires being reported to the national level. Hmm. But second, their national government developed risk analysis tools that are very good tools, very good software that they've given for free to all of the fire brigades. And all of the fire brigades are using it to plot and display where the fires are occurring and where they should target their efforts. And they are going every day out to households, mostly by scheduling them. They don't just go and rap on doors for the most part. They get the households to call them, or they call the households and arrange times to go. And they have another added quirk to this, which I thought was incredibly effective and innovative, and that is they've hired in some cities a core of what they call advocates for different ethnic groups. So if they're visiting a Chinese household, they bring somebody who speaks Chinese. If they're visiting a Bengali household, they'll bring somebody who speaks the appropriate Indian language. Hmm. If they visit somebody who is an alcoholic, they bring somebody who specializes in alcoholism and may help refer them to an alcohol program as well as advising on fire safety.
Hmm.
Now, what they're doing during the home visits also is nothing short of amazing. They're not just talking, they're doing. If you don't have an adequate set of smoke alarms, they're installing for free 10-year battery smoke alarms, tamper-proof batteries that you can't take the battery out and use it for anything else without destroying the detector, and it's a funny shape, so you can't use it. They're advocating on any risks they see. They will advise on how you're controlling your children, or they'll advise on how to be a safer smoker if they see that you're a smoker. They give very pointed advice, and they record a rating on the risk of the household before, when they first came in, and then changes they made, and then they're going back, and they may come back in a week or a month or 2 years, depending on what they feel the risk is of the household, to check on what's happened. Well, you never know for sure whether a program is just window dressing or not, but what's happened in the last 10 years is they've reduced their residential fire death rate by another 40%.
Holy cow, that's amazing.
And they started at the level that we're at now. We have been terrifically effective over the last 30 years in the United States in reducing our fire death rate from what was once in the 30s per million population down now to around the 10 to 12 deaths per million population, which was actually below where Europe used to be. But now the British were at that level 10 or 15 years ago, and they've come down another 40% by this direct assault on households.
And how's the public receiving it?
The more interesting question is how the firefighters are receiving it.
Okay.
The public is receiving it extremely well. Mm-hmm. But this has required a culture change in the fire service. And one of the things that accelerated the change is a question you asked me a little while ago. I told you one was an individual in the fire service going, British fire service going along with him.
Mm-hmm.
But a second culture change came from a nationwide strike that the British firefighters called several years ago. And two things, they called the strike because they wanted a 40% raise in pay. And two things happened as a result of the strike. One, there were no fires, no fire deaths. The fire fatality rate dropped precipitously while the fires were out on strike. And what that showed was that when people are scared enough, you can reach them, they'll change their behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
A second thing was they lost the moral high ground. And when they sat down at the contract table again, the fire service negotiated with the firefighters and said, look, you want to get paid more, you want to get paid more like white-collar workers, you got to behave more like white-collar workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to buy into prevention and not just the blue-collar part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And they have.
Wow.
And, you know, it's been slow and reluctant, and there's still lots of skeptics, but firefighters have been getting a lot of rewards, feedback from kids and households that have stopped throwing rocks at them, literally.
Hmm.
The British had a problem we don't have, which is having rocks thrown at the fire service when they respond to calls in low-income neighborhoods.
That's unbelievable.
Kids stole things off the fire trucks.
Yeah.
And now they're presenting a much friendlier face of the fire service. They're
mm-hmm.
they're getting cooperation from the low-income ethnic communities.
Mm-hmm.
And in the hardcore places like Liverpool and Birmingham, industrial England, have had remarkable drops in their fire death rates.
Well, I suppose one of the big advantages that the UK has over us, too, is it's a national fire service. It's uniform across the country.
It is not.
Really?
It is not a national fire service. It's a locally controlled fire service.
But isn't there a national body that controls or develops standards and things like that uniformity?
They used to have more than they have now.
Mm-hmm.
They had Her Majesty's Chief Fire Inspectorate, and they went around and inspected fire brigades against standards, and they controlled some purse strings that went toward buying apparatus, but not totally. But it's
right.
always been a local since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Before World War II and after World War II, it's been locally controlled. But
mm-hmm.
what the British did was reduce the number of brigades dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So they only have now, and the number keeps changing, but it's like on the order of 45 fire brigades that protect all of the United Kingdom.
And how large is a brigade? That can vary.
And the brigades typically are protecting like 1.5 to 2 million population. There's often a central city and some smaller towns and rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
Some brigades are like focused on London or Manchester, but others like West Midlands or Merseyside have these colorful names. Merseyside protects Liverpool and then quite a bit of population around Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what that means is they can put the chiefs of the fire service in one room and make policy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that they have a national fire service, it's they have a manageable fire service.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And you can put 45 people in one room or 45 fire marshals in one room and have a consensus on what everybody's going to do. It's a little harder to do when you got 34,000 fire departments.
It certainly is.
Now,
don't they now, don't they have a national fire college over there, too, that
yes.
many of the officers have attended?
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. And they're a very good national fire school. And so they have, you know, it's sort of more of a system, a comprehensive or coordinated system than we have, but it is not a national fire service. And in fact, it's gone the other way now of doing away with the national standards of cover and saying every locality figure out risk analysis for themselves and make the decision where they want to be between how much is on prevention and how much is on suppression.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's amazing. How about Sweden? What did you discover up in Sweden?
Now, in Sweden and Norway, have an even more radical approach going on than the UK. They now, by law in Norway, are required to have one prevention officer for every 10,000 population.
Mm-hmm.
They are bringing more educated officers into the fire service, technically educated, in risk analysis. They call them fire engineers. And it's a two-year program at their national school, and they're bringing in virtually every fire brigade, people who are expert in doing risk analysis to try to figure out where's the best way to apply resources.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that just shocked the heck out of us when we were doing this study there was when you compare how many people are on prevention versus how many are assigned to operations during a given day, the proportion might be 10 on prevention and 16 firefighters out there for a community of 100,000, plus the ability to call up reserves if they really need it. I mean, there's a much larger percentage of the force is assigned to prevention than we have. And again, with striking results, their response time standard in places like Sweden and Norway, it varies from city to city, but in many places I visited, the response time standard was 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be considered, you know, extraordinarily poor in the United States.
Right.
But they trade off prevention for suppression. They're putting more weight on stopping fires in the first place than afterwards. There's another startling thing going on in Scandinavia, particularly in Norway, and that is they're requiring not only a smoke alarm in every house, but either a fire extinguisher or a hose. And they're telling people that flashover occurs in 2 to 4 minutes in a modern household, which is the same we have also.
Right.
If you got a fire going. They're saying we can't get there in 2 to 4 minutes, we the fire service. So for those first few minutes, if you want to stop a small fire from becoming a big fire, you're going to have to put it out.
So it's a case of putting more personal responsibility on the owners versus
yes.
over here, we just advocate, get out, get out, get out.
We make sure extinguishers are hung at the right level and have the right pressure, and then we tell people ignore them and run right out past them.
Right, yep.
And they're saying use them safely. They're helping train people on how to use them. They're not advocating firing a conflagration. They're saying, you know, you have a small fire, use an extinguisher, put out a small fire.
Mm-hmm.
They're also advocating closing the door, which is a very effective strategy.
Right.
So again, it's prevention. Now there's some gizmos, devices that we found in our visits that I think also are of great interest. I don't know if you'd like me to mention a couple of those.
Absolutely, yeah. Please do. Keep on going. Yep.
One big problem everybody has is cooking fires. And in Norway in particular, I was struck by a very simple approach they have to reducing them that has been very effective, and that's put a timer on an electric stove. And they actually sell stoves with the timers built in, but you also can buy a relatively inexpensive one and just plug the stove into it. And then when you cook, you set the timer for 20 minutes or 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
When it's built into the stove and you have an elderly person or somebody who is an alcoholic, and they turn the stove on and forget to turn it off, it'll turn itself off.
That's an excellent idea.
You have to reset it if you don't, if you want to cook longer than 20 minutes or 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just an astoundingly clever, simple approach to a really complicated problem.
Now, is that a voluntary sort of thing, or is that...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, up to this point, it's voluntary, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They go so far in Scandinavia as to install a mist sprinkler system in a household that they consider incorrigible smokers, elderly, alcoholic, who they can't get to exhibit safe behaviors. And there is a mist sprinkler system that's a self-contained unit that's good for 1 or 2 rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Costs about $2,000 or $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's portable.
Mm.
And they'll put it in the room of highest risk if there's a smoker. You got somebody who's 80 years old and they won't stop smoking. You also know they're going to drink, and you know they're going to fall asleep with the cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
They'll install the system, and they only do that on a very limited basis, but they have that tool in their toolkit.
Now, when you say they install, who installs it? Is it the fire service installs it, or
yes, the fire service? Yes.
At no cost to the owner?
Yes, at no cost.
That's amazing.
There's yet another strategy that we use, but not to the extreme I found in Scotland and in Scandinavia, and that is partnerships. The fire service in these various nations we visited have said we can't do the job ourselves in visiting households, particularly some of the hardest to reach households like those with shut-in elderly. Okay, we don't get to see them.
Mm-hmm.
They divide the elderly into mobile young elderly and old elderly or elderly that shut-ins. They said the shut-ins are the ones that really are the big fire hazard. So what are we going to do? The fire service forms alliances with the health agencies and the social services agencies and trains their people who are going in to check smoke for smoke alarms and other hazards. And if they see a household that has cigarette burns all over, they'll call the fire service in to do a home safety check. And likewise, if the fire service goes into a household and finds somebody's alcoholic or elderly and they're not getting the treatment they need, they'll notify the services.
Mm-hmm.
In Scotland, that's become codified in law that the fire service is required to work with partnerships. They're required to meet with other sister agencies on a quarterly basis, and they'll have somebody assigned full-time to do that.
Amazing. Now, I guess kind of the million-dollar question for us over here is,
yes,
out of all the things you saw over there, and they sound absolutely fantastic, how much of it would work over here?
I think virtually all of it.
Really? Yep.
We always say, well, we're a different culture. Well, they were a different culture. I mean, Britain was a different culture 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they have fought through the culture change to get the politicians to understand risk analysis and how it's better for all of society if you put your money on the right things. And so they haven't done this with enormously large budgets. They have changed their culture. And what's kind of interesting now is I think we can change the culture pointing to what they have done after they used our work to change their culture. It's a little bit like the Japanese car manufacturers borrowing American technology to increase the reliability of the cars, and then we borrow it back from them again.
Right, yep. Do you see this happening in the near or distant future here? I mean, we're seeing more emphasis being put on prevention, you know, with some of the recent things,
yes,
like Jim Crawford and Mike Love and Ozzy and those guys have been doing.
Yes.
Would you feel that that's perhaps the start of it, the genesis of the movement?
We've
in this
been
country?
Moving in the right direction, and some of this younger blood you've been talking about is helping accelerate change in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But we can go further. The key is to get prevention accepted as a prime task of the fire service as part of operations. I haven't mentioned this before, but one of the striking things in the organization chart on some of the European fire services, when you look to see where prevention is, it's not under support services deputy chief, it's under the operations deputy chief.
Oh, wow, that would be a big sea change over here. Right.
In other words, it's considered the prime service.
Mm-hmm.
And every firefighter is considered to be part of delivering that prime service. And the firefighters are out certain hours in the morning and the evening going to households doing prevention work. There's no question we could do the same kind of thing there.
Are there any departments that come to mind in this country that you see as heading in that direction or perhaps are ones that would be ripe for that kind of change?
I think many are. I mean, there's always some people who are further along than others, and I can't name you exactly who. And nothing that they're doing in the U.K., has not been done here by one or another department. If you pardon the pun, our problem is we don't fire for effect.
Mm-hmm.
We do pilot studies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have all kinds of good ideas, and people do it for a year or two, and then the champion is transferred or loses interest, and the idea changes. And what they have done is codified these innovative ideas. They're saying, you got to do it.
Right.
I mean, the government is saying you got to do it. They've convinced the politicians to make it a requirement that you got to do more prevention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's absolutely astounding what you found over there, and I think this is going to. Now, when is this study going to be coming out? It's fairly soon, isn't it?
It'll probably be another a month or two before we get through all the bureaucratic processes to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
This study was done, by the way, most directly by TriData for the Centers for Disease Control.
Mm-hmm.
CDC, and they in turn got a grant from the U.S. Fire Administration to fund this. And a lot of people don't know that CDC is not their full name. It's actually the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a directorate for injury prevention.
Right.
And that's where the study was done, and I actually traveled with Mick Ballesteros, who's an epidemiologist for CDC, and he and I went and visited fire brigades and the national governments in each of the nations that we just mentioned.
Well, we're going to really look forward to this study when it comes out. I mean, I know the work that you did before, several years ago, looking at Japan and other countries, was absolutely fascinating, and it sounds like this is just going to be a wealth of information that everybody can use in this country in terms of trying to really move the prevention effort that much further forward. So we really appreciate you taking the time here, Phil, to join us on Fire Marshal's Corner.
You're welcome.
Talking about these studies. I mean, I find it fascinating. I'm sure everybody else will. And
well, it's been exciting to write it, and I think it'll be exciting to read it also.
And we'll certainly have that information here on firehouse.com when it does come out. So I assume it's going to be available online, the reports?
Yes.
Great. Okay, well, we've been talking to Phil Shainman, who's the president of Tri-Data Corporation, about the recent studies that he's just completing right now, looking at the fire service and fire prevention in the UK, Norway, and Sweden. So thanks for joining us today, Phil.
You're welcome.
And this is Ed Camo, and we're here on Fire Marshal's Corner with Stephen King, who is a senior analyst with C3 Construction Code Consultants. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Thank you much.
Mm-hmm. Stephen has a really unique challenge and position over in Dubai. Fortunately, he is in this time zone, so we did get a chance to catch up with him. But, Steve, maybe you can start out by explaining a little bit what C3 Construction Code Consultants is about and what you are doing over there in Dubai.
Well, Ed, I have worked for the government for the past 27 years doing fire review and plans review and teaching at the local colleges for code. And recently when I retired, I was invited to go to Dubai by one of the sheikhs in Dubai to help them take a look at their code performance ability and their methods of doing code enforcement and code review and so on and so forth. What C3 was originally formed for is to become a code consulting organization strictly, not an engineering firm, but just a code consulting organization that was to try and help the private sector to handle and deal with some of the problems that they don't understand about code when they get ready to provide projects to the local governments and the local jurisdictions, the AHJs around the country, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so now you're over in Dubai.
It must be
quite an interesting contrast to what you're finding here in the United States.
Yeah, you could say it's slightly different in the United States. The first thing that you have to realize about, and let me make one little correction here. I'm not actually in Dubai. I'm actually in a place called Sharjah, which is the emirate next to Dubai.
Okay.
The United Arab Emirates is made up of 7 independent emirates, and basically Dubai is the one that's getting all the airtime. And they're getting all the airtime because of, $60 billion worth of construction last year and a projected $120 billion in the next couple of years. So there's a lot of buildings going up, and they are going up very, very fast.
what's driving the growth over there? Why is there so much growth going on?
It's an unbelievable combination of international architecture and engineering, and a $1.3 trillion amount of oil money that comes into that country every year. Dubai is just the first emirate to pick up on, sooner or later the oil is going to run out, and we need to do something to turn this into a world-class tourist city, a world-class financial center, a world-class something. We got to have a game plan for when the oil runs out, so that's what's driving it.
So you've got this tremendous growth going on. How are they handling it?
Well, I have a feeling that that's why Sheikh Saud invited me to go down there, is that you have to remember that the first oil didn't even leave the United Arab Emirates anyway until 1962. So that's a relatively short period of time ago. This is a Bedouin country, and then suddenly there was oil and there was oil money. That was a relative short period. At this point, the growth period has only been in the past 20 years, and if you saw pictures of what Dubai and Sharjah and Abu Dhabi and places like that looked like 20 years ago, you would get a scope of how fast they grew up, how quickly they grew up. And not necessarily their infrastructure for code compliance and inspections, reviews, and all that grew up at the same time. Because the local jurisdictions, the AHJs, which are called the Civil Defense Departments in the United Arab Emirates, have the same problem that every AHJ has. They have limited budgets. Believe it or not, they got a $60 billion construction growth, and then their budget is not a reflection of that money. Their budget is a reflection of what the government is allowing for their departments to have. So, they, for instance, in Sharjah, where I'm going down to set my offices up to try and help relieve some of the stress on a third-party basis for inspections, they have one fire protection engineer, a young man graduated from Maryland University some time ago, who was an Emirati. He is was from the United Arab Emirates. His name is Engineer Mohammed. He's reviewing high-rise plans sometimes at the rate of, you know, 10 or 15 a day.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So you see where we have a little problem.
Now, what are they using for codes and standards over there in evaluating these plans?
Yeah, another one of the problems that the United Arab Emirates has is that the United Arab Emirates has a national code, and to tell you the truth, it's in Arabic, and I'm still trying to work out all the details of what the Emirates code specifically and actually says, because, you know, in our business, if you don't know the rules, you can't play the game. But anyway, what that code basically says is that if you're going to build something here, you have to use a national standard, and you're responsible for it. So they design a building in accordance with the British standard, and they take it to the local government. The local government says, okay, you said it's designed in accordance with the British standards, and they issue the permit based on all that. Then the person who's building the building has the responsibilities for taking care of it. There are inspections done by the Emiratis on some routine and regular basis, but not on the kind of schedule that we do in the United States. And, you know, in conjunction with that, one of the things that I'll be doing, one of the first tasks that Sharjah has charged me with is the training of 100 new inspectors just in Sharjah.
Now, you say when you're building a building, you mean, for example, like let's say I happen to have a couple $100 million in loose change kicking around, and I wanted to go over there and put up a building, then could I follow an American code and standard in doing it? Or who determines which code is being followed when the building is going up?
You know, Ed, you have to have a, you have to get a grip, a real strong grip, and if I might suggest, anybody who's really interested in this, there's a book written called Don't They Know It's Friday, which gives Westerners a brief and very close look at how the Islamic nation and the interaction of business goes on. And one of the things that becomes very difficult is that it's hard for us to understand that if the sheikh says, the sheikh is one of the royal male members of the family, if the sheikh says, okay, that's good, then that's good. And the Supreme Council can pass rules and regulations and so on and so forth. As it is right now, basically, there are some accepted standards, and some of those accepted standards are the ones that I use, which is NFPA and ICC.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you could. You could take your spare change and build a building and build it in accordance with NFPA. That is another one of the tasks that I've been charged with here, is that eventually what the UAE wants to do, if they want to set up an ordinance so that they have a unified code system, and they're leaning very heavily towards NFPA, and they're leaning very heavily towards NFPA because it obviously has the life safety requirements that they're looking for, and with some recent fire activity in the UAE, I think they're becoming very, very conscious of it and much more aware of what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to be training 100 inspectors. Boy, that's going to be a pretty large undertaking there.
Yeah, that's to start with. Wait till we get over to the Air Force base. That's the one I'm not looking for.
So what kind of, I assume that you're going to be training the NFPA standards, and they're going to be going out there and conducting the inspections.
Yes.
Getting back to the plan reviews, are they looking at ramping up that part of it as well? So they can, I mean, that's an incredible rate to be doing plan reviews.
Yeah, another one of the first things C3 is responsible for when we hit the ground, and we're still working through the bureaucracy. It's a task. it's a task for men of brave fervor, because going through the bureaucracy of the UA is like, you know, all of these people are encouraging me, and they're telling me, I was, you know, I was showing this project with this Air Force base, and they're, you know, they're just, you know, patting you on the back, and we can't wait till you hit the ground, and blah, 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 blah. But the bureaucracy over there is just unbelievable. We the reason I'm in the United States now is because we had to come back to have documents certified at the State Department and signed by Condoleezza Rice, because they don't accept anything else. Your business documents, your education documents, all the stuff that goes along with it, all of that has to be certified here in the United States by the State Department that it's real. And then it has to go to the UAE embassy, and it has to be certified there. Then you take it back to their country. And we spent, you know, we spent 8 weeks over there just getting the guidelines straight and so on and so forth. So we're gonna challenge this out, and hopefully we can rise to the challenge and get going and get some, you know, solid life safety items going on. There are some things that have happened that are just, you know, some really bad fires. There was a fire just before I left on the 5th of June at the Palm Jumeirah in one of the parking garages. And most of these fires that, you know, are looking really bad, luckily, have occurred during construction. Now, luckily is, you know, we've got 8 guys that died in a high-rise fire under construction, guys that were working on those buildings, and that's another whole issue, but if it was a packed tourist building in December, you know, billions and billions of dollars worth of construction could be in jeopardy because its world image could change very quickly.
What are firefighting operations like over there?
The firefighting operations and the actual physical trucks and vehicles and the firefighters themselves are as dedicated as they are here. I spent some time in the Emergency Communication Center in Dubai, and I was really amazed at the sophistication of their network alarming systems and so on and so forth. However, there are some things that you and I would just find insurmountable to deal with. You know, truck 9, respond, the building at the corner of the square and Amatak Road. And you go, what? Because they have no addresses on buildings. None of the buildings in Dubai or Sharjah or any of those places, because they've never set up that kind of zoning system. Little teeny tiny things that need to have blanks filled in are making it an enormous challenge for the firefighters as more and more high-rise construction goes up.
Now, is it a National Fire Service or is it community-based? How's it?
No, it's a National Fire Service, and it's all funded from federal government funds, and it's underfunded.
Well, just like any fire department anywhere.
Just like
right?
Every fire department in the world, that's exactly right. And I'm hoping that my bosses in Dubai get a copy of this and they hear me say that.
What about fire prevention education? Does much of that happen, and how does the citizenry react to that sort of thing?
I think, you know, Ed, again, 20 years ago, most of these people didn't even have a clue what a high-rise building was. There was one or maybe two, and that was it. And, you know, there weren't that many people there. I think that you have to understand that everything that we've learned over, you know, since 1860 or beyond is being compressed into the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past 10 years, the UAE has put a great deal of dependence on contractors, builders, and developers, and engineering firms in the country. There's some very, you know, there's some huge, very fine engineering companies in the country who have provided code services and code-related issues. But I don't think there's been a national format about fire safety at all. And I'm almost positive that it's one of the things that the UAE is now getting very involved in, because, again, recent fires and recent fire activity in the country has doubled or tripled, and they need to respond to it, and they have promised that they will get these programs in action.
Well, we've been talking with Stephen King, who's a, and not the Stephen King.
Yeah, the other one.
Who's a senior analyst with C3 Construction Code Consultants, who's working over in the Middle East. on helping one of the Emirates set up some code consulting operations over there, take a look at their building construction, which is going at a phenomenal rate right now. So Stephen has really faced some pretty unique challenges, and I'm sure that you have a lot more that you could possibly tell us in 15 minutes here.
Probably.
What we'll do is, if you look on the page below, we'll have some more links with some information where you can go and find out a little bit more about Stephen and what's going on over there. But we really appreciate you taking the time and joining us here today, Steve.
Not a problem. I really appreciate you having me on it.
Well, you've been listening to Fire Marshal's Corner on radio@firehouse.com and another great show with Kathy Gerstner from the U.S. Fire Administration, Phil Shinneman from the Tri-Data Division of System Planning Corporation, and Stephen King from C3 Construction Code Consultants. Hope you found it worthwhile. My name is Ed Camo, and thanks for joining us on radio@firehouse.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.